Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. As the national debate over gun control continues, we'll take a look at just how pervasive gun violence is here in Michigan. And later in the show, we meet a writer and fisherman who finds his inspiration in the Detroit River. But first, we turn to our weekly check-in with Daniel Howes, columnist at the Detroit News. Welcome, Daniel.
Thanks for having me.
So today in your column, you are exploring the very interesting relationship between Governor Snyder and some of his fellow Republicans. And got to say, that relationship is not looking, well, let's steal a phrase from the governor himself, relentlessly positive, is it?
No, it's really not looking that way. You know, he's pushing a $1.2 billion in new spending for roads and bridges, which is falling like a dead old tree in the Republican forest, as well as trying to expand Medicaid to cover more people as part of the Obamacare rollout, neither of which are popular with the Republicans. I think this shows a couple of things. One is it certainly pinpoints that we've got an election coming, and a lot of these Republican legislators have done some heavy lifting for the governor early on in terms of tax reform, budgets, and certainly the tax on pensions, which is not popular. So, you know, and I think they're now at a point, as we've seen in the last 6 to 12 months, where they want theirs.
Yeah, payback time.
Exactly right.
So what's happening then is so much for the party unity line, because you're not seeing it, are you?
You know, it depends on how you look at it. You know, the governor would say, listen, we agree more than we don't agree on. And I think that's probably true. But on some things like the road funding, for example, he's more likely to get Democratic support than he is to get a lot of Republican support. Now, the other thing here is you've got, you know, Tea Party activists who are going to be in the weeds threatening to go after some of these incumbents who are standing for re-election. And that is another issue he's got to contend with. As Bill Ballinger said to me yesterday, and I quote him in the piece, the governor has always been a little to the left of generally the Republicans in the legislature, in both the House and the Senate, and I think you're starting to see that. But there's also a number of issues at which he has not gotten his way. It started with the bridge early on, the bridge to Canada. He wanted to do it a certain way. The legislators said no. We saw it certainly in Right to Work. He said it wasn't on his agenda, and I really think that it really wasn't. I don't think it's part of his DNA, his makeup. He wanted to focus on economic issues and financial issues, which are in his wheelhouse, and frankly, you could argue, are probably the most important in Michigan, I would argue. But you had people push Right to Work. They're now talking about repealing or revising prevailing wage. There was a big Donnybrook over abortion restrictions, which, again, is not something that is particularly in his wheelhouse. And yet they've pushed these on him, and he's had to deal with them.
Now, in your column, Dan Howes, you mentioned it was actually a quote from Bill Ballinger. He thinks Snyder's been very deferential. That was the quote, excessively so to the legislature. Do you agree with that? And does that fit with this whole picture?
I think in a sense I do agree. I mean, a lot of people like to draw a parallel between Snyder and John Engler, which is an obvious parallel to draw. And of course, John Engler came out of the legislature and was viewed as someone who wielded his power very effectively. And I think in some ways he did, more so than Snyder. But it is a bit of a fallacy, and Bill makes this point as well, and I think I agree with him, that a governor is, in this context, able to get his way irrespective with his party. I think the case of that we're seeing is not true, and it wasn't necessarily true with Engler. I mean, he reminded me before I even got here that in 1991, Engler vetoed a revenue sharing bill, and he was overridden by the Republicans in the legislature. You know, your own party overriding your veto, you don't see that very often.
Does a governor need to inspire a little fear in the troops to be effective?
Well, yeah, you talk to people about this, and they will tell you that the governor tends to approach this, his job, more as the CEO of the executive branch or the CEO of the state.
Which is what he's known, right?
Yes, but typically the sitting governor is not only the CEO of the state, but he or she is also the head of the party.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a feeling that, at least among lawmakers, that he's not necessarily the head of their party. He's the governor. And there's a difference there. And I think a lot of that comes from the fact that the governor is more focused on problems. He is approaching his job more like a chief restructuring officer than he is necessarily a politician. And I think he would say that's okay. That's what he's about, and that's also that you could argue that's a weakness. I think you could also argue that it's a strength. That when he says I'm here to fix problems, in a lot of cases, what they find out is that's what he is there to do. There isn't always necessarily a bald political angle. Now, certainly post Right to Work, people would say they don't buy that. And I understand why they would say that. Mm-hmm. But I think if you look at a lot of other issues, and I think the Detroit financial thing is a good example. The state budgeting is a good example. The business tax reform is a good example. This is more about trying to make the state more competitive, and he's focusing on problems and trying to bring solutions as opposed to politicizing every decision, which I think tends to happen more certainly in the legislature.
Now, you spoke with Governor Snyder. What is his take on this?
Well, I think his take is that we agree on more than we don't agree on. We've gotten a lot accomplished. He said, I think I've signed – I didn't put this in the piece, mm-hmm. but he said something to the effect of, I think I've signed over a couple hundred bills. We've got a lot accomplished. And I think they have got a lot accomplished. I'm not sure that everything they got accomplished was necessarily everything he would have wanted to get accomplished. Right to Work, I still maintain and maintained before it happened and as it was happening and maintained today that it will continue to be a divisive issue. I don't think it really affects the business climate of existing businesses. I don't think you're going to see a bunch of union members heading for the exits as soon as they can, despite some of the things you've seen in the public sector. So I think the jury is still very much out on that. And I think people in the business community, the established Michigan business community, would tend to agree with that assessment, that it really isn't going to change their life on the ground so much. The question is what it does going forward. And I think the answer to that is we just still don't know.
Let me ask you about the Democrats now. Have they been jumping on this, we'll call it friction or this rift in some of these issues? Are they using it to their benefit or trying
to? Hard to tell at this point, I would say. I mean, they've got their own agenda. They're pushing, among other things, trying to repeal or soften this pension tax. I don't think they're going to get anywhere with that. And my own view on that whole thing is you tell me why my neighbor doesn't have to pay taxes on his retirement income, but I do if I don't have a pension. And people have never been able to give me a fair answer on that. And I think it's a fundamental fairness question. And irrespective of the fact that that's the way it's always been in Michigan, the question is that the way it should be?
So what do you see as the options for Governor Snyder? As you say, he cannot succeed all by himself, right?
No, I just think he has to keep hitting singles, to use a baseball analogy. Mm-hmm. I don't know that he's going to really hit the long ball so much as he just has to keep knocking things down and getting them done. There's a couple of things really at work here. What's happening in Detroit, I think, is going to be very important to see whether he's been right at pushing the emergency manager. But the broader question is really is one of a broader economic question. You know, a lot of what the decision to whether he's going to be reelected in 2014 is going to have to do with, the economic and the jobs picture in Michigan. And I think it's generally getting a little bit better. Certainly the autos are hiring up. Suppliers are expanding. You're seeing a lot of private capital move into Detroit. That's all positive. And certainly in the West Michigan business community, I think it continues to move on a lot of different cylinders. So fundamentally, he's going to just have to keep knocking things down. I don't think he's going to be able to do some big things. I think trying to get this road tax through is going to be a pretty heavy lift.
Daniel Howes, Detroit News columnist. Thanks so much, Dan.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. We turn now to the increasingly popular sport of amateur MMA, mixed martial arts. It's a full-contact combat sport. It's not for the faint of heart. Fighters may hit and strike both standing and on the ground, and they use wrestling or grappling moves in the fight. Michigan legalized MMA bouts in 2007, professional fights, but nothing for amateurs. And critics in the mixed martial arts community in other states say that is putting lives in danger. Just last Saturday night, a 35-year-old fighter died after an amateur bout in Port Huron. He apparently did not have a pre-fight medical screening. Following his death, State Representative Harvey Santana of Detroit was able to push his package of reform bills through the House, bills that would finally regulate amateur MMA fights in Michigan. Now, the first state to regulate mixed martial arts was New Jersey. That was in 2000, and it included a fully regulated amateur MMA program. Nick Lembo is with the New Jersey State Athletic Control Board, and he's the chair of the MMA Committee for the Association of Boxing Commissions. Nick Lembo joins us now from New Jersey. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So tell us just how tightly regulated is New Jersey's amateur MMA program, and particularly what it means for promoters and officials and for fighters?
Well, it's fairly regulated in the sense that, first of all the individuals who wish to compete have to be identified. They have to be of a minimum age. If they're over a certain age, there's extra medical requirements. We have an EMT, paramedics, and an ambulance on site. We have at least two ringside physicians on site at all times. We have a trained referee. We have to approve the matchmaking, and there are pre-fight medicals that are required for every fighter.
And so can you contrast that with the way that that an amateur bout might be run in an unregulated state like Michigan then?
I mean, not to, you know, I'm not exaggerating, but they'll pull people out of a crowd, you know, to come down and fight. You know, you don't know the age of the fighter. You don't know the skill of the fighter. That's another thing that New Jersey requires. We have a certification form from a trainer that this individual trains at my school for X period of time, and in my judgment, I'm certifying that this fighter is healthy as far as I know and is at a level of skill that is significant enough to allow him to compete in this contest.
It kind of begs a terribly obvious question. Why wouldn't all states regulate amateur fights? Because it just seems like there's so much possibility for someone being killed.
Well, I think states are not in the habit of regulating amateur combat sports. The other big amateur combat sport is boxing, which is under a federal charter from the Ted Stevens Amateur Sports Act and is regulated by USA Boxing. A lot of states do regulate professional MMA now, as opposed to a couple years ago, there was just a handful. But with the popularity of UFC and Bellator and these other organizations now, and the money that is generated to a state and to an athletic commission by their appearance, suddenly a lot of commissions became amenable to having professional mixed martial arts in their state, but they didn't allow or strictly ban, you know, they didn't contemplate what was also coming along with that, was that you're going to have amateurs that are going to want to compete in this sport too, and you have to make sure that it's a safe environment for them. And unfortunately, they were left behind.
So what I'm hearing is that the popularity of mixed martial arts has kind of outstripped legislature's awareness of it or ability to provide regulation.
I don't know if that's true, because I think it is a combat sport. It is dangerous. It is as safe or safer than other combat sports if properly regulated. But in my view, you shouldn't allow it in your state if you are not going to regulate it. And if anything, I would say let the professionals go and regulate the amateurs if you don't have the resources to do it. But if you don't have the resources to do it, you really shouldn't allow it. But it makes no sense to allow, you know, 13-year-olds with little skill, poorly trained or self-trained, to go to an event and bring their own gloves and have no one supervising the hand wrapping and have no drug testing and have them fighting someone that may have 20 more fights than them because they're not even being ID'd. You don't know who they are. And to give you some specific examples, we had one gentleman actually from Michigan come to fight in New Jersey, take all the medicals, and he competed, and he was caught with a punch, and he was knocked unconscious. And he was required a 90-day suspension before he could compete again and to take a CAT scan and get clearance from a neurologist.
Sure.
From his own. And that was something that a trained ringside physician who was on site and, you know, analyzed him, made those recommendations.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he simply didn't do that. He just went back to Michigan and fought the next weekend.
Wow.
So that's, you know, that's an issue there. Another issue is a female fighter that got knocked out in Canada on a Friday night and came down to Michigan on Saturday night and got knocked out in that fight the next night. So when it's completely uncontrolled, it's much more dangerous.
Nick Lembo is with the New Jersey State Athletic Control Board, and he chairs the MMA Committee for the Association of Boxing Commissions. Representative Santana's package of bills passed 106-3 yesterday in the State House. Now it all moves to the State Senate. The legislation would require amateur fighters to be at least 18, to be screened for communicable diseases, and promoters of amateur fights would have to be licensed with the state, they'd have to carry health insurance for fighters, and they would have to have a physician and an ambulance present at each fight. This week, Bridge Magazine's running a series of in-depth stories delving into Michigan's gun culture. It's called Guns in Michigan, exploring a wide range of questions, including what happens at the point where gun rights and public safety intersect, and how pervasive is gun violence in Michigan. Pat Schellenbarger wrote the series. He's a writer based in West Michigan. If his name sounds familiar, it could be because he was a reporter and editor at the Detroit News, as well as the Grand Rapids Press and the St. Petersburg Times. And Pat Schellenbarger joins us now from Grand Rapids. So, Pat, what was the thrust of this piece? Why? What made you want to take such a deep dive into the gun situation in Michigan?
Well, of course, you know, the idea began with the shootings in Newtown, Connecticut of the 20 school kids and the six adults. But we, of course, decided to take a closer look at Michigan and what's happening here. And while so much of the focus nationally is on assault rifles, as it should be, the fact is that the vast majority of firearm deaths are with handguns. And, of course, Michigan has become a shall-issue state back in 2001.
Explain for us, for those folks who are fuzzy on these issues, how did changing Michigan over to a shall-issue state make it easier to get a concealed pistol permit?
Okay. It used to be pretty difficult to get one. You'd have to go before your county gun board. You'd have to prove that you had a need, that you needed it for defense, you'd been threatened, something like that, so that there were not that many carry concealed weapons permits, or they're called concealed pistol permits, issued back before this change in the law. The legislature changed the law, and it went into effect July 1st, 2001. And after that, the state had to issue the concealed pistol license unless there was a reason to deny it, such as the person had a felony record. So since then, the number of concealed pistol licenses has gone up dramatically. That first year, there were something like 52,000 concealed pistol licenses. As of April 1st this year, there are more than 378,000. And each of those permits can cover multiple handguns. So it's hard to say how many handguns are out there that are being carried now.
So that's why the data is kind of fuzzy.
It is.
Yes.
And there are over 25,000 applications pending right now, and that's maybe double what it was a year ago.
Now, Pat, you report in your piece that the number of firearm homicides in Michigan actually went down after Michigan became a shall-issue state, so the sky did not fall in?
No. There were predictions back at the time that this was being debated that there would be shootouts in the street, that sort of thing. That has not happened. It's true. The number of firearm homicides has declined, and the number of firearm suicides has declined, though not as much. But it is important to point out that the violent crime rate was already declining a few years before Michigan became a shall-issue state, and nationally, violent crime was already going down. And statisticians, epidemiologists, and others will tell you that there are multiple factors that go into that. So it would be faulty to say that because Michigan became a shall-issue state, the number of firearm homicides went down.
I want to talk about guns and schools, and as you say, your whole series, the idea came from the Sandy Hook school shootings. And for this series, you really did something that was very riveting. You spoke to some people with real perspective on school shootings, unlike anyone else's. Talk to me about the folks that you interviewed with regards to that school shooting that happened in Chelsea.
Yeah, that was back in 1993. And I thought this would be an interesting case to look at because there has been talk and even a bill in the legislature that would allow guns in schools. Guns are now among the gun-free zones under state law.
Yes, and that's Senator Mike Green's bill?
That's right.
Yes.
It would allow teachers and others to carry guns. Well, the shooting that happened in December 1993, the superintendent of the Chelsea schools was killed. The principal of the high school was wounded, and a teacher was wounded. But the thing about that case is that the shooter was a teacher. And so I talked to the principal, he's now retired, about his view, his experience with that, and his view of the whole issue of arming teachers. And, of course, he is opposed to that. And he favors some forms of gun control, such as banning assault rifles, and he favors universal background checks for those who want to buy guns. But then I also interviewed the teacher who did the shooting, and he is in prison. He's doing life in prison. He was remarkably candid. He takes full responsibility for what happened. But he hasn't given a whole lot of thought to this issue of gun control. In fact, he told me that he tries not to follow what's going on outside the prison walls because it reminds him of what he did. But when I pressed him on it, he didn't think that gun control would really make much difference.
Why was that?
Violence. Well, he sees it as a deeper problem, a decline of morals in society in general. And since he has gone to prison, he has become a Christian, so he looks at it more in those broader terms. But his feeling was that you can restrict things, but that's not going to change the level of violence.
I'm speaking with Pat Schellenbarger, who's a contributing writer for Bridge Magazine, and his pieces this week, overall series entitled Guns in Michigan, exploring many, many questions and delving into Michigan's gun culture. And in your pieces, Pat, you talk about the mental health, and we've certainly heard a lot of talk, especially since Sandy Hook, about mental health. And you call this the wild card in gun safety. And why so?
Well, it is one of the big issues, and it might be one area where the pro-gun factions and the pro-gun control people can agree that better mental health care might help prevent some of the violence. But the problem with that is it's nearly impossible to predict who will go turn violent. And I had talked to people in the mental health field about that, and they do say that people with certain mental health conditions may be more prone to violence. If they have a history of abuse, they themselves were abused, that might increase it. If they've had a history of alcohol and substance abuse, that increases it. But even applying all those factors, you'd be wrong the vast majority of time. One thing that has maybe made a difference is the states are required, or expected at least, to report involuntary commitments to mental treatment to the national database that the FBI maintains. That's the database that, you know, a gun dealer has to check through before they can sell a gun to someone.
Mm-hmm.
And some states have not done very well with that, but Michigan has done better than most. Michigan was one of the best, according to one survey I read. But even at that, it's still very difficult to predict who will turn violent.
In all of the reporting and the writing you did for this series, did you feel you could come to answer a central question, which is this: just how pervasive is gun violence really in Michigan?
Well, it's fairly high. One of the most interesting facts that I came up with surprised me, and that is that in Michigan you're more likely to die from a bullet than in a motor vehicle accident.
Because we're making cars safer, aren't we?
That's it. And that raises kind of a related issue that that maybe the approach, and some of the one researcher in particular suggested this, that maybe the better approach is not so much gun control but gun safety. It might also include limiting those who have guns, but also things like requiring or promoting the idea of locking up weapons and keeping ammunition separate from those. But it's not so much that the number of firearm homicides and suicides have gone up. It's that the motor vehicle accidents deaths have gone down.
Pat, what do you hope readers will take away from your series, Guns in Michigan?
Well, I hope they become aware of just how dangerous it is to have a firearm in the house. There was a survey by the Michigan Department of Community Health a few years ago that found that about 40% of Michigan households have a firearm in the house. Yet, the Brady campaign for firearm safety had predicted that firearm is 20 times more dangerous to the occupants of this household than is any intruder. It becomes too handy. If an argument, between a husband and wife escalates and there's a firearm readily at hand, it might be used. If someone is feeling suicidal and they can get a hold of a gun, they might use it before they've had a chance to kind of reevaluate it.
Or as you found in your interview, if a teacher is angry at a personnel action being taken, he can come back to the school and kill the principal.
And I just yesterday heard of this stabbings that occurred in Texas at a college there. 14 people were stabbed, but not one of them died. But if it had been a firearm, firearms are more lethal.
Pat Schellenbarger, his Guns in Michigan series, running all this week in Bridge Magazine, and you can find it at bridgemi.com. And Pat spoke to us today from Grand Rapids. Thank you so much, Pat.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There's a new twist now in the Greek tragedy that has become the money woes of the Kilpatrick family. As Michigan Radio's Kate Wells reports, former Congresswoman Carolyn Cheeks Kilpatrick, the mother, of course, of former Detroit Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick, will be getting $20,000 to conduct a hearing into alien conspiracies.
Look, I am going to be the first person to admit that it is not nice to get excited when public figures do crazy things. But this is one of those stories that just begs the question, really? The Kilpatrick family matriarch, a woman who makes Lady Macbeth look laid back, is going to run a panel of congressional-style hearings. The goal of these hearings is ambitious. Get the federal government to admit that aliens exist, that they've contacted humans, and that for decades the government has been covering all of this up. Now let's get one thing clear. This is not actually a congressional hearing. It's all being put on by a group of alien conspiracy theorists calling themselves the Citizens Hearing on Disclosure. They are shelling out $20,000 to each of the five former Congress members who've agreed to come to D.C. for this panel. Stephen Barrett is the chief organizer behind these hearings. And in a trailer on YouTube, you can see him wearing a Steve Jobs-like black turtleneck and talking about how it has been more than 40 years since Congress took a real interest in the extraterrestrial issue.
In those 4.5 decades, hundreds of thousands of new sightings have taken place. Government agency witnesses have come forward. Media coverage has expanded. Hundreds of documentaries have been produced, thousands of books have been written, and yet the United States Congress has remained silent.
Now, if you are surprised at the former Michigan Congresswoman's new keen interest in UFO sightings, it's worth remembering the $20,000 she's making for this trip. Plus, her son, former Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick, is flat broke. And you may have heard he recently started what looks to be a long stint in federal prison. Meanwhile, Cheeks Kilpatrick didn't even have enough money to convince the court that her son wasn't a flight risk. She offered up her house as insurance, but the court declined. The alien hearings, meanwhile, in D.C., will run from April 29th to May 3rd. I'm Kate Wells, Michigan Radio News.
Well, if you should find yourself on the Michigan State University campus this week, brace yourself. Don't be surprised if you smack right into a zombie. That's because this week, hundreds of Michigan State students are taking part in the third annual Spartans versus Zombies game. In short, the zombie apocalypse has engulfed the Spartan nation. Shannon Missouri helped bring this humans versus zombies game to Michigan State, and she joins us now from her dorm in East Lansing. First of all, Shannon, am I talking to a human or a zombie?
Well, technically neither. I'm considered an admin, so we're kind of the neutral party, you could say. We neither support the zombies nor the humans. We're here to make sure that everyone's having a safe and fun game.
So you're like the referee.
Yes, that's a great way. Yeah, the referee and the creators and the judges.
Okay. So tell us, what's the goal of the game and how does it work?
It's just basically like if you think of a game of tag, just times 10. You're just having people with running around with Nerf guns, and they're humans trying to basically, like, you know, survive the zombie apocalypse. And if you get tagged, you become a zombie. And so then you're kind of now on the flip side, and you're a zombie trying to make other humans become zombies.
And how does a human repel a zombie? What weapons do the humans have to keep the zombies at bay?
Well, as you can see, if you're walking around campus, you're going to see a lot of people running around with Nerf guns. But, you know, another thing, too, people can use instead if you don't have a Nerf gun, we actually roll up socks, and those are considered grenades. And so if they hit a zombie, then they're stunned for 15 minutes, and they can't tag anybody. And so they have to wear, because each the humans and zombies, you're able to tell who's who by armbands. If you're a human, you have to wear an orange armband around your arm 24/7 when you're outside.
Okay.
And if you're a zombie, you have to wear it around your head. And so that's just to distinguish who's on what side.
And what are you all getting out of playing this? I guess the process of just running and playing and having something besides looming finals to think about.
I would say definitely getting people outdoors. You know, despite this rainy weather, that hasn't really deterred many people from playing. In fact, a lot of people are really into it since it's been raining and pretty kind of like crazy weather. But, you know, just a lot of it too is like I've found, even as like an admin, I've met a lot of friends through this, and it's just been a great experience, like meeting people and kind of bonding over the fact that, like, with your fellow Spartans, just like doing a game and something, like, it doesn't matter like what major you are or what kind you're into, because you're all just trying to survive the apocalypse. And it definitely, as finals are coming in, definitely gives a nice like stress reliever and just a way to kind of like, if you have some extra energy to pent out, it's just something that's really fun. But definitely creating that bond, I would say, and being outdoors is like a big thing for, I guess, like our Spartans versus Zombie organization.
Well, actually, it's interesting. I'm coming up to visit my daughter at State tomorrow. So when I see people with bandanas, now I'm going to know. Arm is human and headband is a zombie.
Yep.
Shannon Missouri is an organizer of the third annual Spartans versus Zombies game happening this week at Michigan State University. Thanks so much, Shannon.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Everybody's got a story. Some are very extraordinary stories. It might be good for somebody to look into theirs.
Because a story is the shortest distance between two people.
Allison Downey curates stories for our ongoing series, The Living Room.
It's April, springtime in Michigan. And after 10 years here, I know that springtime might mean the occasional snowstorm in May. But generally, I can depend on seeing my driveway after months of being buried in white. The rivers are beginning to rush, and the lakes are filling, and my friends, who are diehard fishermen, have their poles and tackle boxes ready by the door.
I fish because it's really stinking fun.
I am Willie Jones. I live in Kalamazoo, Michigan.
This is Jeff Jones. I'm from Kalamazoo, Michigan.
My name is Colby Jones.
I take my boys fishing largely as an excuse to get out on the water and to get out in nature.
We don't usually catch big fish, though I have caught an 18-inch small bass. Thank you very much. There's a saying that my mom or dad says, you can catch 10 fish a day or catch no fish in 10 days. It's very, very true.
And there are those for whom fishing is not only an important family tradition, but a creative act. Michigan-based writer and fisherman Pete Marcus is in that category. The river and fishing inspire his work, and his writing is kind of a hybrid of fiction and poetry. He's got this tendency to say volumes with just a few words that he repeats over and over again. Words like fish, river, and Bob. Living Room producer Zach Rosen recently spent some time fishing with Pete on the Detroit River.
A lot of people say, where's Trenton? I say, well, if you're in downtown Detroit by the Hart Plaza, jump into the river, and eventually you end up in Trenton.
Do you write when you're here?
No. I fish when I'm here. The fishing is hopefully better than the writing, you know? I don't think I'd mix the two. I write about fishing when I'm on land and wishing I could be out on the river. So I'm out on the river. I don't need to do anything else. I'm good. It's a good cast.
With the grace of a corpse. In a riptide, I let go, and I slide, slide, slide down river.
When did you start writing about fish?
I think the first time I wrote about fishing was I wrote a fly fishing story, but it wasn't until I started writing about these brothers who grew up not far from a river like this, and maybe it is even this river. And then I couldn't stop. And then the Bob book came out of that.
Was there ever a time that Bob wasn't on the river?
Bob would, he'd go into town to sell his fish. I know that about him. Pretty much, he was sort of like a fish in that everything he did revolved around the river. Bob fishes a different type of fishing than the approach we're taking here. Bob's on a boat. He's a handliner, which meaning he's not fishing with a rod. He's holding the line, the wire in his hand, and he's basically bouncing the bait in the deeper part of the river, in the channels. But Bob fished all the time.
Fish, you know. fish.
Sometime fish, but most of the time what Bob did with the fish was Bob sold the fish. It's how Bob lived. A boat, a river, fish, a man, Bob.
I just always preferred fishing at night because it's quieter, there's not as many boats.
Sometimes at night, when the fish are slow to bite, Bob looks up from the river and looks up into the sky for stars. Some nights, Bob sees how many stars in the sky he can count. One night, Bob counted up to 222. That was a bad night for fishing. That was a good night for counting stars.
Bob was certainly a fish at one point in his life. And I think I probably was too. There's got to be something that explains this sort of irreverence and the way that the river definitely trips me up into a reverie every time I am near it. We might have a little nip. You see that? We got a little bit of some action there. Let's be patient this time.
Look at Bob's hands. His knuckles are rivers. The skin on Bob's hands, fish scale covered, they look like they've been dipped in stars.
My cousin and I used to fish. We used to fish up in Lake Huron. And we'd leave our rods out overnight. Sometimes we'd come down and the rod would be gone. How big was that fish that dragged that whole rod away? There's always something mythic about that fish, you know?
On a good night of fishing, on a bad night for counting stars, Bob can fill up his boat with more fish than there are stars up in the sky. Nights like this, Bob's boat is no longer just a boat. It is a constellation of fish.
Did you ever have fish, like at home? Like in a bowl or, that sort of thing?
With my children, we always had a goldfish. It's a good way to teach kids about death. I remember when one of our goldfish died, my son was very kind of spiritually connected to it and very fascinated with holding it in his hand once it was dead. I've got a beautiful picture of him, you know, with the big old goldfish cupped in the palm of his hand and sort of, you know, looking up at the camera. Not exactly sad that it had died, but just, you know, knowing that it was a good fish. I just remember thinking that he was in touch with something pretty sublime and real. You know, I mean, what I think fishing and fish teach you about death is just that, you know, you're pulling up these fish and hopefully you're making use of them. They don't end up on the riverbank dead, but you're killing them, but you just felt like they were giving you back something that you had to respect, you know. And I was never of, you know, like, oh my God, I'm hurting the fish. It was just sort of what their purpose was. They were beautiful. I loved them. I loved catching them. I loved, you know, I was just utterly fascinated by them.
There is no such fish that is just a fish. Every fish is a beautiful fish. Everything that is beautiful in this world is a fish. The moon is a fish. The river is a fish. The stars in the sky, the stones in the river, the mud on the river's bank. Fish, fish, fish.
It looks like you're getting a tug here.
Now let her tug it into the water.
My name's Peter Marcus. I'm a writer from Trenton, Michigan, a town with a river running through it. When I'm not down by the river, I teach writing in the Detroit Public Schools as a writer in residence with the Inside Out Literary Arts Project of Detroit.
Pete Marcus is a 2012 Kresge Literary Arts Fellow. Tomorrow night, as part of Kresge's ArtX Detroit, you can catch an artist conversation with Pete. Information about that event is on our website, michiganradio.org. The Living Room is produced by Allison Downey and Zach Rosen.
Now go to sleep, you fishermen, and dream of rookies rising. Hemingway's two hearts was just the fox to our surprising. The one thing that I try and understand and figure out is why we get so excited by a 6-inch rainbow trout. Going back.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside was engineered today by Bob Skahn. Contributors are Allie Billings, Austin Davis, Emily Fox, Mercedes Mejia, and April Van Buren. And we had special help today from Chrissy Zamoran. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan.